Jana was up here, she'd try and take a drink from one of these. But she didn't. So I want to give you an illustration before we start, before we even read the word this morning. And it used to be done as a children's message, but it involves a certain form of honest deceit that I began to get uncomfortable with around the children. So here's what I'm going to do, and because it's a long, narrow church, I'll come and show you what this is. What I have here are two identical white mugs, or at least that's how they started out, right? Two identical white mugs. And I need you to imagine that you are very, very thirsty right now, that you're severely dehydrated, and I have a nice glass of water back there on the pulpit. Again, identical mugs, white mugs. And I have some water there on the pulpit that I can share with you, and so I'm going to ask you a question of which cup you would want me to put some water in to share with you who are very, very thirsty this morning. You do not have to participate, but if you want to, by show of hands, if you desperately needed some water and had to choose one of these mugs, how many of you would choose this one as the one that I should pour some water into? Okay, good, good. And how many of you would choose this one? Okay, those are the people that read the passage ahead of time. Okay. So, those of you who chose this one, you would want me to put some water in with this so that you could drink it. Right? So let me just walk up and down the aisle a second. And this was the fun part of doing it as a children's message, because you'd get, ooh, right? We picked that. And I'll just do the other side too. I won't do the whole trip for this, for the last cup. But yeah, the kids all, and depending on the dirt that I found, it sometimes smells too. Yeah, there's a good ooh, right? So you would have chosen this one here. And those of you who I presume read the Bible passage ahead of time, chose this one. And we could just wipe the rim a little bit and we could put some water in there and you could probably get a fairly safe drink of water out of that. And so these are, you'll catch on fairly quick. Sometimes I read the passage and I think, do I still need to preach? But I do anyway because I have to feel like I'm earning a paycheck, I guess, and doing the Lord's work. But now let's look at the passage for today. And that's in Luke chapter 11. Starting at verse 37, and just four verses there, and later on we'll look at Mark chapter 7. This section is called Six Woes. Another way of saying that is six warnings. And Jesus has just finished speaking to a group of people or a crowd about this little light of mine, in fact. No one lights a lamp and puts it in a place where it will be hidden, and also about how good light and good eyes help us to see more clearly. And I think he's talking about spiritual light there mixed in with other things. And then we read this. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him. So he went in and reclined at the table. You might know that that's how they did it. They didn't have chairs like we do, but they lay alongside of a platform. But the Pharisee, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, was surprised, and so it must have shown on his face. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people, did not the one who made the outside make the inside also? But give what is inside the dish to the poor, and everything will be clean for you." And the word dish, where it says the dish, in most translations, I like the word vessel, because it takes you away from thinking about cups, and just as a unit that carries things. So it has multiple possible interpretations. So now I want to take you down memory lane, some of you. For those of you for whom this is not memory lane, please just enjoy watching the people around you go through memory lane. For some, it might be memory lane of this morning, and for that, I'm sorry. But for many of us, it's memory lane of our childhoods, of Sunday morning in our childhoods. When we were told we couldn't go outside right after breakfast. When we were told we had to stay inside and we had to go get out of our pajamas and put on some special clothes that were just for Sunday. How many of you grew up with clothes that were just for Sunday and maybe weddings and funerals? Yeah. Okay. So we had to go find those clothes and neatly put them on and then not do anything that might crumple them or dirty them in any way. Basically do nothing from a kid's perspective. Nothing any fun anyway. And then the time would come when everybody got gathered into the car. This was memory lane is the day before seat belts, and so there'd be arguments about who sits where if there were multiple kids. There might even be a little one who asks to lay in the back window. Yeah, we used to do that. And the car would pull out of the driveway, pull away from the house, and then that moment would come where Mom in the passenger seat turned around. Some of you are in this memory lane, I can hear it. Yeah. And the inspection would come. Inspection involved a lot of chin grabbing, a lot of face checking. It involved some comb action if Mom had a comb with her. And then woe to the child. If you're thinking of, if you were here two Sundays ago when I had dirt on my face, woe to the child who had a little bit of peanut butter or chocolate or Kool-Aid mustache on their lip. Woe to the child. And if you were fortunate in this memory lane trip, then Mom had a clean handkerchief. If she had forgotten it, what would happen then? There we go. There it is. That's what I watched for. Yeah. The thumb. The lick and the thumb. And the cleansing would begin. Okay, so this is, yeah. And some children of some generations would object to this and would raise questions. Why do we have to go through all of this? Why do we have to dress up for church? And parents all had their own answers. Often the answer was along the lines of we want to look our best for God. But as those children grew up, they began to realize that a lot of it tended to also be about what would people say if we didn't dress up our kids and bring them clean to church. And in my case, that's especially true as the oldest son of a pastor. Later on, I started realizing that in the days that I grew up in, the behavior of the children of the pastor was supposed to be exemplary. And so that added another layer to all of that. So there's a danger when we have those practices, a danger that some of us have had to grow out of and wrestle with, that as children, we learn to think that church is all about looking good. It's all about appearances and being on our best behavior. When we go that way, what is really in our hearts and what is really going on in our lives gets masked. And that becomes part of the practice of church. That's why, as I've told you before, I won't repeat it again in detail, but that's why I like the one particular song by Ken Miedema out of the hymnal. And it all gets hidden behind a facade of looking good for other people, behind our good appearance. And so there's a danger in all of this that Sunday morning and then church life in general can become all about putting on your best appearances, and it can have nothing to do with your inner life, with the state of your heart and your soul and your spirit, and nothing to do then also with the state of your relationship with God. It's just about if you successfully make it through a Sunday without spilling coffee or Kool-Aid on your shirt. That was a good Sunday. It's a danger. I'm playing with it a little bit, but it's a danger I hope you recognize. A class that I was in at seminary on domestic missiology, which is doing mission to the neighborhood around you, In one of those classes, we were given an assignment, and you have to imagine, if you know Grand Rapids at all, this is in Grand Rapids, Michigan, in a seminary. And the assignment was that we had to interview 8 people who were not currently involved with church. And we had to ask them why. We had a set of 3 or 4 questions about what had created that not being involved with church. And we made lots of jokes about, because Grand Rapids has like, I don't know, at that time, I think it was 32 Christian Reformed churches within several, you know, within about 10 kilometers. And then equally many Reformed churches and all kinds of other churches as well. So where are we going to find people who don't go to church in Grand Rapids was kind of the joke. And some of the classmates said, well, I'm just going to go stand at the mall with a clipboard like they do. And I'll have to ask a lot of people probably to get to my 8 so I can get my answers. And myself, on my way, I was thinking the same kind of thing, trying to think about which mall to go to, and on the drive home that day, I was stopped at a red light in the inner city in Grand Rapids, and I looked over to my right, and there was a boarded up house with exactly 8 what we would call vagrant men sitting on the porch. And I thought immediately, there's my 8 people. And then I thought immediately what a crazy idea that might be. And I went home, and over supper, the family agreed. Crazy idea, Dad. Don't you dare. You know, go to the mall. I'll come with you. You know, that kind of thing. And so next day at seminary, I shared the thought with some students, felt classmates, and they said, too, the same thing. You know, that's risky, Pete. That's a bit too much. And the professor walked up as I was talking to some of them and said, what are you talking about? And so I told him this crazy, crazy impulse that I had. And he said, I want you to start a Bible study with those guys. Professors are no fun sometimes. So I did, and there's a whole long story there. I did go and talk to them, and it was an amazing experience. And their answers collectively, when they finally would answer my questions, their answer was, we're not good enough for church. I was just shocked to hear that from them. Because I knew, in terms of my own theology and our own theology, that church is for sinners. But somehow, these were people who had been given that impression. And I asked, why wouldn't you be good enough? Well, I don't have good clothes. Well, I might smell like alcohol when I come. I might, you know, and so they had other things that would be barriers. One guy thought he needed a Cadillac. Couldn't understand why I was in training to become a pastor and didn't have a Cadillac and drove up in a beat-up old van, which is why they thought I was undercover police to start with. But we're not good enough for church. And that has that just since that incident particularly has resonated with me, and the shock kind of still lives. Outward appearances is what religion seemed to be primarily all about for most of at least the Pharisees who are talked about here in Jesus' time. And we all have Pharisee in us. So I'd like to read now another passage that tells us a very similar incident, and it'll serve as a bit of a background because Mark himself explains some of what is going on. Mark 7, first 1-8, and then jumping to verse 20. The Pharisees and some of the teachers of the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around Jesus and saw some of his disciples eating food with hands that were, quotation marks, unclean, that is, unwashed. And then Mark explains, the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they give their hands a ceremonial washing, holding to the tradition of the elders. When they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And they observe many other traditions, such as the washing of cups, pitchers, and kettles. So the Pharisees and the teachers of the law asked Jesus, why don't your disciples live according to the tradition of the elders instead of eating their food with unclean hands? And Jesus replied, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you hypocrites, as it was written, is written. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. They worship me in vain or vanities. Their teachings are but rules taught by men. You have let go of the commands of God and are holding on to the traditions of men. And then to verse 20. Jesus went on. He said a few things in between. What comes out of a person, what comes out of a man, is what makes them unclean. For from within, out of men's hearts, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, lewdness, envy, slander, arrogance, and folly. All these evils come from inside and make a person unclean. So the main tradition in focus in both of the passages in that we read is that of washing before eating. And as far as we understand, it was a ritual in which a person took water, a pitcher of water that was prepared, and there was a specific pattern for how they had to pour it on their arm. We believe it was up to their elbow, and do each arm that way before they went in to eat. And it was a specific amount and, you know, certain things that needed to be done. If you've ever attended a mosque with a friend, you'll see something actually very similar happen where they have a washing ceremony on the way in. Now, this washing was not about germs. Germs hadn't been invented yet, as I'd like to say. They hadn't been discovered or identified yet. So it has nothing to do with what we would think of washing would mean. No, it has more to do, and I'm going to do some memory lane stuff here again, maybe. It has more to do with cooties. Does anybody know the word cooties here? Did you grow up with it? Right? Us boys were told girls had it, and we had to stay away from them, and the girls were probably told the same about us. And it was just some kind of a, you know, mysterious substance or virus or spirit or whatever that you didn't want to get. You didn't want to be called a person with cooties. And so this is actually close to that. They didn't want to pick up cooties from people in the marketplace. And so they had to do this ceremony. They also had to do this ceremony the way they understood it, because it was what made them acceptable in God's eyes. They were not acceptable before God if they did not wash in this way. And so it got pretty complicated. It was a ritual that was supposed to guarantee that you were ceremonially clean before God. So in our passage in Luke, Jesus gets invited to lunch. And he does not follow the tradition of the elders by using the water ritual to make himself pure before setting down for a meal. And those who take great credence in such things were shocked. Now, he already had a bit of a reputation, but they're shocked again to see in person that the guy just walked in and got ready to eat. But you see, Jesus sees right through the pretense of all of this. The mistakenness of the pattern in which we as church throughout the ages create patterns that we believe are the things that are going to make us okay with God. And we keep insisting on trying to earn our own salvation that way. And Jesus knew and was trying to demonstrate that that's not how it worked. No end of washing your hands can save you. I once had the opportunity to work with a person who was a compulsive hand washer. And it would have been interesting to hear his life story. And because I began to wonder, what was he trying to cleanse himself of that he became so obsessed with washing his hands? That's an extreme of what they were doing here. Jesus knows about mankind's natural tendency to make up rules by which we can measure our obedience, so that by which we can look good. And he knows that the washing of cups and utensils in his day and hands were part of that. Now, there's an important thing to catch in this passage. And that is that Jesus draws a parallel between the cups and dishes and people. Did you catch that? Next time you read it, hopefully you'll catch it even clearer. He said, "You Pharisees clean the outside of the cup and dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness." He's calling them out. Nice and shiny on the outside. You can keep buffing that. But there's something wrong inside, he says. And so when he's talking about cups and dishes, he's talking about people. And he uses his host's reaction to try to get his host and others there to see that it is the cleanliness of what is inside that counts before God. What is in the heart? What is the heart doing? What is treasured most by the heart? And how is it remaining pure and soft, to use other language from the Bible? He's after, Jesus is, the core of their being. Not always what things look like on the outside. Matthew, when he tells of this incident, because it's told a couple of different ways and by different people, has Jesus saying, first clean the inside of the cup and dish, and then the outside will also be clean. And wouldn't that be true? If we ran running water into this cup for a long time, eventually the outside would become clean as well. But here's a problem that comes from the illustration, or the illustration works for, and that we need to become aware of in the church. Let's just presume that we're a church that's going to start from this perspective and wants to learn to do this cleaning that Jesus talks about. Jesus has provided a thing called living water, the work of the Holy Spirit, that can begin to be poured in here to start the cleaning. But what's going to happen on the outside if we start that? It's going to look like that. And so we'll be a mug that's somewhere in between the two. Actually, dirt on the inside and on the outside. And we teach and believe that in this life, we won't achieve a pure, shiny, clean, fresh out of the dishwasher cup. That will come another time in another phase. First, clean the inside of the vessel, of the person, and then the outside will also eventually become clean. And so what it creates in the church when we are all a church of people like this is that when somebody just spills just a little bit of a struggle out onto the outside, we all have a problem with that. And we don't leave room for that to come out. And we teach them even early on, now, no crying in church. Right? And we teach them to put it away. Or if someone has something more serious that they're struggling with that they want to talk to you about, and you become all uncomfortable and don't want to actually just let them speak of what they need to speak of, to admit a struggle that they have and to pray with them in that struggle, then we don't create space for that spirit to work. And for me, one of the things that's upsetting and that I need to be honest about is that in recovery groups, that's exactly the foundation of who they are. And in my view, the church has somehow lost its mission in that perspective, in that way, in that role. This also explains, this illustration, church leaders, particularly semi-famous or famous pastors, who fail in a big way. And suddenly, blah, all the dirt's all over the place and all over the headlines. And we're all kind of embarrassed to be part of that. Because for church leaders especially, if there's no room for them to deal with their struggles in an open way, then they just keep piling up the dirt, and then one day it overflows. So this is what Jesus was trying to illustrate, using this pattern that these Pharisees had, and as I said, we all have Pharisee in us. We all love to have rules by which we can measure our obedience and our goodness so that we can feel like we're doing good. It's inside. What's inside the person is what God is concerned about and what Jesus is concerned about. Later on in his life, Jesus was killed by the very same people he gave this challenge to. In other words, there was evidence they had not dealt with the dirt and the hatred in their hearts. And they hadn't succeeded either in insisting that Jesus start to look just like them. And so he was killed by them. It overflowed. Their corruption, inner corruption, overflowed into murder. But fortunately for us, that murder became a release. In Jesus dying and rising again, in Jesus releasing the Holy Spirit for us, we can have access to the tap of living water. And we can become individuals and communities that work on that inner cleansing, alone and together, however it works best for us. Jesus was killed by the very people who judged the person by external ritual cleanliness. He was put to death because he threatened their carefully prescribed process for remaining externally pure, for appearing to be pure. And in the end, their evil thoughts won out and became an evil deed of murder. And we've looked at Cain, how that happened with Cain. It's a pattern that's very, very dangerous. Jesus died according to God's plan because men like his host at this meal wanted to do away with him because the darkness in them that Jesus named was running amok. People of God, it's only through Jesus that we have the power to fully purge impurity. And so it is my hope and my prayer that we can learn together. It takes time. Don't all start tomorrow. That'd be a pretty big mess. But start in a little way tomorrow, looking in your heart. And if you see character flaws, things that you think you could change, share it with a trusted friend. And trusted friend, let the person share their struggle and pray with them in that struggle. And throughout the history of the church since Jesus formed it, and today in church basements in 12-step groups, people find healing in exactly that process that the church tends to forget. May we as a people, and I'm going to ask you to say amen to this, may we as a people grow in learning how to do this. And God's people said, amen.